Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update, an original podcast from Charles Schwab, provides an information-packed daily market recap in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Joining us now, nobody better to speak about what we saw over the United Kingdom, as well as the potential agony over lag effects, how to understand them. John Riding, Chief Economic Advisor at Breen Capital, former Economic Advisor to the Bank of England on this Thursday. John, when you take a look at some of this data, which isn't softening quickly enough, and you hear the hardline talk from the Federal Reserve, what's your sense about how far behind we are in terms of lag effects and when we'll actually see the ramifications?
Well, Lisa, as you know, we had many discussions last year where I said that inflation was not transitory, was going to be a real problem, you know, and it still is. And I mean, interestingly enough, in the numbers that Mike went over, you know, he didn't mention the prices received data by manufacturing firms in the Philadelphia region, which, like in the New York region, went up to 34 and change from about 31. So we're far from having defeated inflation at this point. And I would also take a little bit of issue on the rent story for two reasons. One of which is rents in the CPI are rising roughly in line with the overall CPI. So they're neither adding nor subtracting to the overall rate of inflation, where people, you know, paying for housing, paying for food, paying for energy are really important in forming people's inflation expectations. So the fact that new rents are declining when people are paying the higher level of existing rents, I don't think it's inappropriate. But this idea that we always take out the bits that are pushing up inflation and look at inflation excluding that, you know, I find a bit problematic. Yeah. Because policymakers never do it the other way.
Okay, this is really important because there are all these people coming out there, and this is the biggest pushback and the reason why we've gotten lifts in markets. People say there are disinflationary elements, and you pointed to the rent story, you point to the used cars, you push back, and you say that those are completely offset and then some by the other indicators. Is that right?
Well, yes. I mean, we've had, and I actually think Fed policymakers are somewhat on top of this. We've had three months of the 10 months which have had CPI data, where the so-called core, excluding food and energy, only went up by 0.3%. And it was then followed by inflation picking up again. So, yes, one report where you got an odd treatment from healthcare costs. Health insurance costs fell 4% in the CPI. Now, I'd love to have that health insurance policy, and I'm sure most people out there would love to have that, but I don't think anybody's health insurance costs fell by 4%. But my point is, inflation is the overall price index, and you can pick and choose and take this number out and take that number out. But the reality is, inflation both here and globally is a problem, and central banks have created, or at least made the problem worse, by staying too easy for too long after the pandemic. And that liquidity and that that stimulus has to be soaked up. Now, just one second, Tom, if I may.
Please.
There is a communication issue going on at the Fed, a further change in communication. Say, look, there's three things about policy. How fast are we going to raise rates? And they've clearly signaled they're going to slow the pace of increases, and the market's got that story right. Then how high are we going to raise rates to? And then how long are we going to keep them there? And I think the market's got the how fast right. It's slowing. But I still think we're offside on how high. and how long rates are going to stay there. Markets are pricing in barely reaching 5% on the Fed funds rate, and then the Fed quickly cutting rates thereafter.
I'm amazed by that conversation. Absolutely. I totally agree with you. I'm amazed by the certitude that they're going to do a pivot or whatever you want to call it. This is an historic day. The Chancellor of the Exchequer stood up and said, we have austerity. You and I read Paul Johnson, 1987, The English Disease. It was a beautiful essay about the struggles of Clement Attlee, Churchill, and the rest coming forward. What is the level of crisis in your United Kingdom right now? Is it something that's solvable? Is it a two-year recession, as Bailey talks about? Or is it an English disease that is larger?
I think that's a very difficult question to answer. I think the finances of the economy, prospectively going forward, are in better shape now than they were prospectively with the budget, the mini budget that's put forward in September that helped spark the whole crisis in the gilts market.
Mm-hmm.
But the UK is still struggling with Brexit and struggling with inflation issues. And the Bank of England, I don't think, has raised rates quickly enough or early enough to get on top of that. But now we're faced with this very interesting question. I think the US may be faced with it. Can policymakers raise rates enough, tighten policy enough to get inflation under control without sparking a significant financial crisis?
Is the Phillips curve operative right now in the financial stability John Williams talked about yesterday? Are these traditional theories operative right now?
Well, I think the Phillips curve hasn't been operative since the late 1960s, and I think
way.
It is
full
very.
I knew what the writing answer.
Very interesting that
it gets him going.
Very interesting that the very flat Phillips curve that policymakers talk about, you can keep pushing unemployment down without raising inflation, comes back as something that's going to cure the inflation problem. I mean, the main thing about inflation is expectations, and having people and companies understand that higher inflation isn't going to be allowed. And what we have in, for example, in this Philadelphia Fed report here, we saw it earlier, is company cost increases slowing, but the price increase is not slowing. Now, yes, the October numbers were a little bit encouraging,
right?
Probably most in the PPI, but there's a big difference between inflation
right.
having peaked at levels we never thought we were going to get to and getting back to price stability.
John from a Christmas tree farm north says, ask him about England, U.S. in the World Cup.
A nemesis team. We lost 1-0 to the U.S. in 1950 in the first World Cup England played in. And then back in 2010, we tied 1-1. Day after Thanksgiving, it's going to be a great time. And I'm going with England, obviously.
I'm shocked. John Riding, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Right now, we are thrilled and honored to bring you for Global Wall Street, Ian Lingen. He's head of U.S. Rate Strategy at BMO Capital Markets. I called up Jersey and I said, I'm only talking to people today that have read Frank Fabozzi cover to cover. In the bond world, folks, like Lingen's world, you have a Frank Fabozzi textbook of some 900 pages that prices out hardcover at $132, and only Lingen has read the thing cover to cover as well. Is this curve inversion in Frank Fabozzi's classic text?
Frank Fabozzi was not looking for a curve inversion of this depth. I think more importantly, what Frank would have said is that this is a mispricing that needs to be rectified in the short order. We are taking the other side of that trade. We think that there's more inversion to be realized, and the most important inverted curve is Fed funds versus 10-year yields, not just twos versus 10.
So you're going from the vanilla spread of 2-year, 10-year out to the many different spreads you look at, and you're going from very short term out to 10. The dynamic of two different yields moving around, which pros are encyclopedic on, and frankly, our audience is like, say what? Is it about focusing on the 10-year dynamic or the 2-year or the Fed funds dynamic? Which is more important?
At this stage, I would say that the 2-year yield reflects monetary policy expectations in the very short term, but the 10 and 30-year rates, that's the market simply moving on to what's next, and what's next is going to be a pretty significant economic slowdown. So the inversion is simply a tale of two different curves more than anything else.
The yield curve contraction right now presents a huge challenge for the Federal Reserve, massive, because what you're seeing is the more they lean into hawkish talk, the more people buy longer-term treasuries, which ease financial conditions. It is this really difficult situation, a paradox for the Federal Reserve. At what point do they break something? At what point do they have to break something with rate hikes in order to get the market to say, even if you have lower rates, it is not good for risk assets?
I think that ultimately what ends up happening is the Fed's watching real rates as much as anything else. Real rates remain elevated by the standard of the last decade or so. And eventually, we're going to see a more significant pullback in risk assets and equities. I've personally been surprised that the S&P 500 is roughly 10% off of the lows. That also contributes to easier financial conditions. So the more quickly the market is willing to price in a pivot, the more the Fed will ultimately need to do.
At least you see that in the Bloomberg Financial Conditions Index, which was one standard deviation now and has rallied back more accommodative to negative 0.82 standard deviations.
So this really raises an issue, especially as you hear John Williams basically saying, if we break something, we're going to keep rates where they are. We're not going to lower rates. And then people in the market say, are you? We don't really believe it. So how do you view this, right, in terms of if something breaks, what does that even mean for the Fed to get some sort of response? Is the market right?
So I think that there's an argument that the Fed is going to break something and allow it to be broken for longer than it has in prior cycles. So is that the S&P 500 down 25% from here? Maybe. It's not down 50. If stocks are off 50%, the Fed is going to need to respond in one way, shape, or form. What I think is more interesting when we look at what's being priced in the market, there's an argument there's 50 basis points of rate cuts priced in for 2023. Essentially, that's what we're looking at. That's either 100% confidence of 50 or 25% confidence of 200.
But what does it mean for something to break? What are you looking for to break that would even cause a Fed response?
So a stronger dollar leads to emerging markets under strain defending their currencies. That could be a contagion issue. That's very much top of mind. But this cycle, I expect that what will ultimately break is going to be in the real economy. It'll be on the household level, and it will be spending, and we'll be faced with a traditional economic slowdown that the Fed is content to allow play out for a while.
I got 14 questions. Let me go to the Chancellor of the Exchequer, who opened his autumn statement today saying so much was international ramifications upon his beleaguered United Kingdom. Is our curve inversion a symbol of a Fed misguided that is redounding upon other nations, including Britain?
I think that the issues facing external markets are in part a function of the fact that the Fed has pushed back against becoming the de facto central bank to the world and has been focused primarily on the U.S.
Right.
And that has come at the expense of other economies.
What does this inversion mean for our banks and the financial stability John Williams wanted to ignore yesterday? What's it mean for J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, the super regionals, and smaller banks out there doing business with business?
So traditionally, an inverted yield curve is bad for the financial sector because a steep curve implies the ability to create money via carry. The reality is, though, higher rates are generally better for banks than lower rates. And so if we are generally in a higher rate environment, I think that we'll find the financial sector not responding the way it typically has to an inverted yield curve.
What are you going to do here? What's this change in strategy for the next week or so?
I think that the market is getting poised for a breakout even more inverted from here. We're looking
Well, give
for,
me scale. Come on. To a tenth of a percent
wants,
point. Where are we going?
A number?
Negative 75 basis points in twos, tens, path of least resistance.
So we're on the edge of Volcker inversion. We're on the edge of 70, 79, 80 inversion.
I would say we could get as deep as a negative 100 basis points by the end of the year.
What does that do to our listeners and viewers? This is, folks, 45 years. I've never heard this. What does it do to us?
I think that it really leaves us in a anxious position where we don't know how far the Fed's ultimately going to need to push things because they'll be coming out with even more hawkish rhetoric because, as Lisa points out, that will lead to a lessening of financial conditions.
Did he just say there's going to be extra special more Fed speak?
Oh, it's the Fed reality show. And this is what people are watching. And we all cling to every word as much as we want to say. Does it really matter if they keep talking? Well, Well, yeah, actually, markets move up every time they do.
Our esteemed team that puts a show together every day called up Ian Lingen today and begged. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Nick Benenberg joins us right now. He's international economist at Wells Fargo, and maybe more than anybody I know, nails foreign exchange more on a longer term basis as well. Let's dovetail your work over the years with foreign exchange into international economics. Is the study of the dollar, is the study of foreign exchange valuable in gaming out international economics right now?
Well, yes. I actually think maybe the study of international economics is more helpful in terms of the dollar because we've definitely seen differences in growth. Europe's already in recession. The United Kingdom, the Eurozone is very, very close to being there, whereas the U.S. is holding on, you know, pretty well. I think that's going to be sort of more influential in just the relative growth trends helping the dollar for now, but seeing the dollar depreciate later.
So the study, and forget about Q4, we're almost through it. The study into next year, is it a study of what the U.S. will do, or is it more centric on what Europe will do, Japan will do, a beleaguered United Kingdom will do? Which side of that trade is the one we should focus on?
You know, I think there's always a focus on the United States, and, you know, perhaps quite rightly so, the largest financial market, the largest economy in the world. And as you earlier noted, you know, a comment here or there from the Federal Reserve policymakers, and we've seen, you know, yields higher and the dollar higher as well. So I think that's where the surprise is going to be. We believe that the Federal Reserve funds rate is going to go above 5% up to 5.25%. And so I still think it's Federal Reserve monetary policy for now that's going to drive the dollar a little bit higher and keep those foreign currencies probably on the defensive.
Let's talk about some of that monetary policy. Jim Bullard in comments talking about how we're not yet restrictive. Also saying this, he cites policy rules suggesting rates between 5% and 7%. This is Jim Bullard of the St. Louis Fed moments ago, or about a half an hour or 20 minutes ago. How much are we looking at something that is going to cause the dollar to surge to levels that people are not expecting and cause some sort of fissure here that needs a response?
Well, I mean, those rules or those targets are, you know, probably a moving point. And, I think a 5% level, and 7% is a long way, but I think a 5% level is reasonable when you've got these inflation numbers at 7 or 8%. Now, I think longer term, you know, maybe in the region of 2.5 to 3 is kind of more reasonable. I think in the current context, these very high rates are more than appropriate. I think, you know, from your perspective, or the other question, part of your question was, will we see the dollar surge to levels that we haven't seen before? I think we'll get back to recent peaks and maybe slightly above. For now, the dollar's moving higher. But the end of the inflation problem is probably in sight, and so we'll probably get back to recent highs, not go above them.
What would an interest rate, a federal funds rate of 7% do to an economy with this much debt?
That's the Grandma we're saying. Nick, I'm sorry. You know, she does this. She goes excessive.
Well, it would probably, we already think there's going to be a recession with the high inflation weighing on purchasing power, with these, you know, housing market being affected by these high interest rates. So unfortunately, it would be a deeper recession than what we would expect. But again, not the pandemic and not the global financial crisis.
Did you say 7%?
That's what Jim Bullard of the Federal Reserve of St. Louis said that it could get up to. Of course, that policy rules suggest rates between five. It could
be irresponsible. What would Dudley say to that?
He might be in agreement because he was someone who got out front. But my question
7%?
Is, the issue has been this market has been able to tolerate interest rates well beyond what anybody thought previously were expected. So now we're suddenly readjusting to a new normal.
Nick, you've done so well over the decades in gaming the market. And particularly your expertise in foreign exchange. I'm absolutely fascinated by if you think all these fancy people are overcome by events, and that if you get 5% or 6% or 7%, whatever the nation is, they're overcome by the politics of it, including what we saw in the United Kingdom this morning.
Well, I don't know if they're overcome by it. But, I think that... We're going back to levels that we haven't seen in a couple of decades. We've got inflation that we haven't seen in a couple of decades. It's all a moving target, and no one really knows where the peak is. What I would say, though, and again, why we think interest rates don't go to 7, maybe they get to 5, why we think the dollar gets back to its previous peak, is we're starting to see the first encouraging signs on the inflation front. Those supplier delivery times are down a lot. The commodity prices are down. Some of the shipping costs are down. So, you know, we think there's still some further dollar strength to go, there's still some interest rate increase, but we're pretty heavily focused on sort of the first quarter, second quarter of next year as being the peak, and hopefully things will improve from then.
Nick, thank you so much. Nick Benenbrook with us with Wells Fargo.
What we're seeing right now is a market that continually is surprised by the same message being sent by the Fed over and over again. Why is the market surprised? I don't understand. Let's speak to the market. Beata Kerr is going to represent the market today. Co-head of Investment Strategies at Bernstein Private Wealth. I'm curious from your perspective, why is the market surprised that the Fed keeps getting more and more hawkish in the rhetoric?
I'm not sure that the market's surprised. I think the market's trying to find its footing. The same things that you've been quoting this morning, all investors are struggling with. It is a macro-led market. We're focused on earnings and differentiation in companies, but there's no doubt about it that inflation, like you said earlier, is the key to market direction.
What's the sense of consumer spending? And I say this because at the same time that you have Fed officials saying we're not seeing signs of slowing, it's not trickling in as quickly as we would like, we see the likes of Kohl's having a really hard time. We see the likes yesterday from some others having a really hard time. Target not doing well. How do you parse out the winners from the losers with some sort of narrative that really gives you a sense of where things are heading?
Well, there's two different narratives that you can start to interpret from the retail sales data as well as the earnings from these companies. First of all, you look at the macro picture and say, what does that mean about what the consumer has left to spend and where in the consumer spending bucket, who's getting most affected? And there's no doubt about it that the low-end consumer is squeezed more. That's not surprising. That's what we've historically seen. When you see food and gas prices up over time, that's what's happening. Walmart, we note that they noted over 100,000 consumers are spending more on groceries at Walmart, right? But then you start to differentiate between these retailers and you look at a franchise like Costco, membership-based, huge loyalty, done an excellent job, not just on supply chain, but on labor, and it makes a big difference. So I think when it comes to the micro, the time now is for stock selection and company differentiation. Companies are different in how they're able to manage the chain and labor as well.
You talk in my book. But what I love in your research note, and you get down to something that was gospel in my house, SPX midterms up 16%, presidential year up 8%. You got to be kidding me. The history of these midterms we just had inflicted upon us is double-digit SPX return?
Well, we have to be careful saying history always repeats itself.
Come on, stay with me. It's showbiz. Yeah. Stay with me here.
It would be awesome to see a 16% recovery post the midterms. That is what history said, Tom, and that is what we've published. But you got to get back to fundamentals and stay balanced. I mean, Lisa's point earlier about surprise. You don't want to be playing the game of trying to switch asset classes and sectors in a fast way here because there is so much surprise that's possible in the market. And I think the midterms are some element of surprise as well, obviously. So I think you have to be humble and you have to be balanced.
Okay, you got to be balanced, but do you buy quality? I mean, you buy small cap quality, mid cap quality, big stuff, Apple, whatever. Give us a differentiation of those sectors that create the active alpha you're predicting.
Yep, you must have read our note. Quality growth is an area.
My people read the note. I don't read the notes.
Yeah, quality growth is an area that we like, and I think we like it most in the large cap space. Small caps are interesting as well, but obviously we feel we could be entering a recessionary period. And even if that recession is mild, critical. Small caps could be more vulnerable.
Lisa wants to jump in here, but this is critical. Are you going to see record use of cash by those big cap quality names?
I think we could. I think they've got more strength in their balance sheets. They've got more ability to maintain quality just on labor as well. Obviously, you're seeing cuts and ad spending and in tech, but there's still quality names like Microsoft, like Visa, that we find attractive.
I know. This is what your zombie thesis. This is what you're going with this. I know exactly where you're heading. Carry on. But I do wonder, Brianna, just to build on that, because it is an important point.
Carol would never treat me like that.
It's an important point, this sort of question of what's going to lead to the catharsis where you get capitulation by companies to be purchased at a discount from other companies, mm-hmm. at what point you get some sort of washout. What are you looking for to signal? And I understand company specific, but on a broad level, are we there yet? How do you know?
In terms of company risk-taking to lean into.
In terms of stock valuations, in terms of the appetite of investors.
Yeah, I don't think we're at total capitulation. I mean, we think we may have seen the bottom. We feel like we're in a range-bound market, somewhere in the 3,600 to 4,000 in the next 6 to 12 months on the S&P. Our base case is for an earnings decline that we have not yet seen factored into the market. No. Those bottom-up earnings forecasts are just starting to come down. You're starting to see 22 come down, 4Q come down. 23 hasn't yet been touched.
Right.
And that's because that visibility is so murky. Mm-hmm. Everybody's struggling with the ultimate Fed question. But you're seeing companies starting to respond on cost management. That's going to play out on margins. And that bad news for people is unfortunately good news ultimately for the market and for earnings.
What's fundamental here is we now have a risk-free rate. We now have finance somewhat back to what we are weaned on. And my great theme is the zombies of all flavors are going to be rolled up in 2023. Mm-hmm. Bernstein's heritage, the black books of Bernstein's heritage is studying that. Do you see combinations and transactions on fire next year?
I don't think we've put out a forecast for M&A volume.
No, I know you haven't put out a forecast. Nobody's watching. Come on, help me.
We're continuing to see M&A volume be robust. I think what you're seeing here is financial conditions and risk-taking obviously have gone up recently, and I don't see a real change to that. I think companies are continuing to innovate and invest for the future, and if they can do that with roll-ups and mergers, then why not? Right. But I think they're going to be opportunistic.
Beata Kerr, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you.
Private Wealth Management Today. This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie's based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Heard, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.